Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga, and here is what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. France and Algeria have almost always had strained ties. But what's behind the latest wave of tensions? Also, success in Tanzania as the country reduces deaths in the maternity ward. We'll hear more about it. And what's the alternative? A heartfelt testimony from a tobacco farmer in Malawi, as reports say demand for the crop is in decline.
The global decline in tobacco demand has severely impacted my livelihood, making it increasingly difficult to meet basic needs such as food, adequate shelter, and education for my children. We continue to grapple with the challenges posed by an industry that has become increasingly unsustainable for people like myself.
It's Wednesday, the 5th of March. First, we go to Paris. Tensions between Algeria and France are reaching new heights. And beneath the headlines, there is a deeper story, one which is rooted in politics, history, and shifting alliances. But the escalation in this now deteriorating relationship follows a series of high-profile incidents. French Prime Minister François Bayrou recently announced that France would re-examine its migration agreements with Algeria, which was once cordial. That's after the Interior Minister accused Algeria of trying to humiliate France by not cooperating with deportations of undocumented Algerian nationals back to Algeria. The situation worsened after an Algerian national committed a violent attack in France, which intensified French frustrations. The growing rift has also been fueled by controversial cases, such as the deportation of Algerian-born writer Boualem Sansal. France's recent actions, such as backing Morocco's sovereignty over Western Sahara and escalating diplomatic measures, does not help. And then there is France's internal politics, specifically the rise of anti-immigration sentiments, which also plays a part, with some politicians framing Algeria as a threat. To unpack this, I spoke to Jalel Achaoui, an Algerian political researcher based in France.
If you ask a typical French politician, they will describe relatively recent difficulties experienced with the Algerian government. And if you ask Algerians, they will refer to earlier events. So it's like with every political crisis, it depends on where you decide that it has started. The bottom line is that in 2024, there were two major events that occurred with respect to Algeria in France, in French politics. You have the fact that Macron, who prior to that had the reputation of being relatively lenient and pro-Algeria, according to some accounts, decided to change to basically introduce a very profound change to French diplomacy vis-a-vis the Western Sahara. For almost 50 years prior to that, the French were pro-Moroccan, but had maintained a degree of ambivalence. And then suddenly, sometime last year, France basically embraced the position of the Trump administration. If you recall, in December 2020, President Trump, in his final weeks, issued an executive order saying that the U.S. Was now finally recognizing the Moroccan character of Western Sahara, which is a huge territory, ignoring the UN, ignoring the international law. And France basically did the equivalent last year. And obviously, the Algerians, who had already experienced the American decision in 2020 as a backstab, were very resentful and angry after seeing the decision on the part of Paris last year. This explains a lot of the bad mood that could be observed on the part of the Algerians. The other event that I wanted to refer to in French politics is the fact that a lot of the public discourse on the part of mainstream political parties moved to the right. So there was basically a shift. When you go in that direction, you need to demonize someone. You need to speak about migration. You need to speak about the Algerian citizens that need to be deported.
Is it just politics coming into play here? Or have there been specific incidents where, in fact, Algerians living in France have committed some certain crimes, and because of that, they have faced arrests and probably recommended for deportation back to Algeria?
The deportation has always been an issue. I mean, it has always been a painful problem. Processing those deportations has always been costly in terms of time, costly in terms of coordination, in terms of money. Algeria has always been difficult. Of course, it has become more difficult over the last several months, but there was never a clear legal framework. There was never a proper modus operandi between the two nations. And it was always a big, costly adventure on the part of France to be able to have Algeria accept that a given individual is indeed of Algerian nationality and should be accepted on Algerian soil. Obviously, it has become even more painful for France because of the geopolitical reason that I mentioned earlier.
So in your opinion then, why isn't it easy for Algeria to accept these nationals back to their country?
As I said, there's no proper legal framework. There's no way of expediting these procedures. So right now, if France, let's say, had just waken up without the Western Sahara problem, without any problems with Algeria, and decided to clarify the legal framework to expedite those deportations, maybe it would have stood a chance to have a positive, constructive conversation with the Algerians, who, again, are difficult. I'm not denying that. But that's not what happened. Now there is a political exploitation of an issue that has been part of the landscape for years. And the politicians that we see vocal every day talking about Algeria in France, they're not really looking for a solution.
So before France, you know, declared its stand on the Western Sahara issue, what was the relationship with Algeria? How are these two countries working together, putting in mind that one is the colonizer of the other?
It wasn't great, but it wasn't bad. For example, the personal interactions between the two presidents was very good and very friendly. The current president of Algeria has decided to make a big issue out of the historical recognition of whatever crimes were committed by France during the colonial period. France, of course, has been very, very slow in response. And part of the political spectrum here doesn't appreciate that there's an expectation on the part of Algeria. Another thing that it should be noticed is that from a economic perspective, the foreign direct investment from France, for instance, had reached a ceiling. France has stopped being very important for Algeria in the current environment. Now you have China, you have the US. The transition into Trump 2.0 has been relatively smooth from an Algerian perspective. And at the same time, France is actually increasing the number of its problems with Algeria.
Right. So you're saying at some point France did stop being important for Algeria. But is Algeria still important for France? Does France still need to keep that relationship with Algeria going, given the fact also it's lost some of its influence in West Africa, in the Sahel?
Well, you're raising a very important issue here, is how come there's no self-inspection or self-questioning on the part of France after such a series of debacles in terms of its foreign policy in Africa writ large? Being expelled from Chad, being expelled from Burkina Faso, from Mali, from Niger. It should give France some pause. And there hasn't been any under Macron. It's probably going to stay like this until 2027. Mysterious question. How come France is not questioning itself? Because it keeps failing in Africa. Then is Algeria important for France? Structurally, it is, if only for demographic reasons. There's a huge community of dual nationals. And those people are not going to be wished away. They're not going to disappear overnight simply because this person or this other person happens to be in a bad mood. France should never play with the idea that Algeria doesn't matter and vice versa.
So do you see this as a relationship that is getting worse and worse? And I'm asking you
No.
that because recent times there's been comments, including France, saying that they might even withdraw from an agreement they signed in 1968, which made it easier for Algerian nationals to, settle France.
No, it didn't. That's the problem. It just doesn't matter for Algeria. That Evian Accord from 1968, you can grab it, you can tear it apart, you can throw it in the garbage, nobody will care. Because it ceased to matter years and years ago. France doesn't have anything that it can put at stake in order to scare Algeria into behaving differently. So the situation is very sad. It's just going to be mediocre and just kind of decay very slowly for the next couple of years, potentially. A wonderful scenario that I see is just things decaying very slowly until 2027.
For the people that are Algerians or have their background in Algeria that are living in France, how are they feeling about all this and how are they reading all these events?
They're scared. Questions are floating up in the air, like what does it mean in terms of the ability to access consular services, the ability to travel. So there's a big question mark in terms of day-to-day issues. What we see is ministries in France that could, I'm not saying they have done it, but they could potentially just create problems for regular citizens just to spite the government in Algeria.
Algerian political researcher Jalel Hachawi. The birth of a child is usually a happy occasion, but sometimes things go wrong and the life of the newborn or even the mother is lost. Many African countries are struggling with this, with the World Health Organization saying that a majority of maternal and newborn deaths occur on the continent. Tanzania was not long ago among the countries where most of these preventable deaths happened. But a program introduced by the government with the support of donors is reversing this trend. A recent study in Tanzania showed that there was a 75% reduction in maternal deaths. The number of newborn deaths also reduced by 40%. We'll hear more about the program in a moment, but first, let's listen to Elina Tibalile, a midwife in Tanzania, and Fatuma Yasini, a mother.
Mama alifika, ilikuwa saa saba usiku, akawa yuko kwenye second stage.
One day, a mother arrived at our clinic at 1 a.m. in the morning. She was in the second stage of labor. When her baby finally arrived, the mother feared that her baby had died due to the many hours of pushing. We used the new equipment to monitor the newborn's heart rate. I had faith in our equipment. We used them to help the baby breathe, and after some minutes, the child's heart rate improved, and the child cried. We were very happy.
To be honest, I was well attended to by the nurses here when I came to deliver my child. My blood pressure was very high, and I couldn't even see. But thank God, they really helped me here. This is my fifth child, but never before have I experienced such a service here at this hospital.
To help us understand what Tanzania is doing differently, I reached out to Dr. Benjamin Kamala. He is the principal investigator of the Safer Births Bundle of Care program, SBBC for short.
SBBC is the result of about 15 years of research, innovation and development, focusing on the day of birth, which is the day where the woman will undergo labor and deliver the baby. So we have several clinical tools that we distributed to the healthcare workers, but also several training tools that were distributed to the healthcare workers. So these tools supported and equipped these healthcare workers and so that they are able to manage the mothers and the newborns accordingly.
So what was the situation like in Tanzania before? Because now you're reporting progress.
So I'll talk specifically about this program that we just published in the New England Journal of Medicine, where we implemented this program in five regions in 30 selected hospitals. And in these hospitals, they are about out of 100,000 beds, 260 mothers were dying at the beginning before this program. And after this program, which is about 24 months, the death declined to almost 60 mothers per 100,000, which is a 75% reduction in maternal deaths. And the leading cause of these deaths were, of course, bleeding after birth, but also hypertensive disorders. And for the newborns, before the program, the newborns, I mean the death within 24 hours, about 7 out of 1,000 live births were dying before the program, which declined to about 4 newborns dying per 1,000, which is a 40% reduction. And the leading cause of these deaths were mostly inability to breathe, but also prematurity.
So what has Tanzania done differently then? Give us the specifics of what the program that you are running did and how that started to improve the situation.
There are a couple of things that we have done differently. First, the intervention focused on the day of birth. So there are many interventions which are focusing on different areas. Another thing was the focusing on capacitating the frontline healthcare workers at the health facilities. And this included training at the local health facilities to make sure that these healthcare workers have skills, competence, and confidence to be able to manage birth-related complications for the mothers and the newborns. So the healthcare workers were able to manage the postpartum hemorrhage and the bleeding after birth, but also to able to manage, to resuscitate the newborn who are unable to breathe. And this was done through simulation-based training. Another thing was the availability of local champions at the health facilities who were able to capacitate, but also to facilitate the, encourage the healthcare workers to conduct the individual training, but also conduct a simulation-based scenario training at the health facilities. Additionally, we are available of the innovative clinical and training tools. So these tools help the healthcare workers and they equip the healthcare workers to be able to train, but also to manage the mothers and the newborn appropriately. Another thing that we strengthened in the program was the use of local data for local decision making. Most of the time when the healthcare workers were collecting the data, they are collecting data for, you know, for administrative purpose. But under SBBC, the healthcare workers produce the data, analyze the data, but also consume the data that they produce, discuss the data and make decisions locally so that they can plan subsequent activities. So combination of all these are the one that we did differently from other programs.
So what can other countries learn? Are there some lessons that they can learn from Tanzania?
Yes. So I think there are a number of lessons. One is what I mentioned about the innovations that we implemented locally. Another important component is the partnership that SBBC is working and partnering with the different organizations or institutions. First, we are working with the government of Tanzania, who is the lead and providing the guidance on the guidelines, but also advising on the appropriate way of implementing this intervention. Secondly, we are working with the professional associations, including pediatric associations, association of obstetricians and gynecologists. So locally, these are the partners that are important to engage when you want a successful intervention program. But also we are partnering with international partners, including the private sector, but also international research organizations across the world, especially in Norway. But more importantly, we are working with the World Bank through Global Financing Facility, who are supporting the program financially, but also provides some technical lead on how to implement this kind of a program. We are also working with UNICEF, also providing technical support on the implementing of this program. So I think it's important that other countries can learn on the partnership. It's important to have the partnership with the government, but also with the research institutions and the international organizations, but also to have a focus on the healthcare workers to make sure that the healthcare workers is capacitated, is equipped and supported to make sure that he or she can deliver. And this will strengthen the healthcare systems of the country, which is very important.
What more needs to be done now? Because you've stated what you and your organization have been able to do, but at a country level, what more do you think Tanzania needs to do?
I think we are already doing a lot because this program, as you have seen in the publication, it was only on 30 hospitals, but now currently we have scaled up to almost 150 hospitals in the same five regions. So we have included all health facilities which are implementing a comprehensive emergency obstetric and newborn care across the five regions. So that's one initiative in the scale-up. But secondly, the government is also looking at the funds to make sure that they support this program in other regions, apart from the five regions that we are currently implementing, so that the effect of this intervention can go throughout the country. We have also worked with the other countries. We are working with Ethiopia, but recently we worked with the Nigeria government in two states, Borno State and the Gombe State, where we have already trained the national trainers and the champions, and they are ready to implement and replicate this program in their setting.
Dr. Benjamin Kamala in Tanzania. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Did you know that smallholder farmers account for almost 95% of Malawi's tobacco production? But amid falling global demand for tobacco and thus the tobacco leaf, a new report from the tobacco industry watchdog, STOP, says that smallholder tobacco farmers in Malawi are not getting the support they need to transition successfully into farming other crops. Some farmers say that the crop diversification programs currently in place are leaving them worse off. There is criticism too that there is a power imbalance between the farmers who rely on tobacco for their income and the wealthy transnational tobacco corporations who profit from the farmers' crops. I've been speaking to one of the researchers from STOP who worked on the report, Maynard Nyirenda. Maynard is also a farmer in Lilongwe, Malawi.
The tobacco farmer has been heavily affected. They have been depending on tobacco for all their livelihood assets, including their basic needs, for so many years. And with the demand decreasing for tobacco, the impact has been very, very huge. Some have fallen below the poverty levels that they were, evidenced by them selling their actual assets that they have accumulated for a long time. Most are struggling to meet their basic needs, such as food, a decent shelter, and decent education for their kids. Now, what's making things worse? One would assume that they would migrate to another crop. However, they are still glued to tobacco, and that brings a lot of problems because it brings in a ripple effect. Because the fact that now tobacco is the only option that they have, which is economically viable, not lucrative, because the tobacco farmers have never said that it is lucrative, but only economically viable. They still depend on it. And then it brings in a ripple effects, for example, health effects, as well as environmental challenges. And therefore, they cannot even also allocate that land that they have, because they have limited land, to other crops and also food. So they're caught up in a maze of a number of social economic challenges.
So how many farmers are we exactly talking about?
In Malawi, we have over 3.7 million smallholder farmers. And in these districts that we're talking about, more than 40% of them engage in tobacco growing.
How come then these farmers, how come they are not getting the support they need to be able to do that?
Both farmers and government have been depending on tobacco. The economy is actually tied to tobacco. That's where we get our forex for so many years, since the colonial times. And therefore, transitioning away right away, it has been a challenge, both for government and the farmers. They don't have a well-structured market like tobacco. They don't have access to extension services and credit and inputs. So we're trying to transition or to go to some area which we don't know, for example, say as a country, or where alternatives are not so clear. That's the first challenge. And then the second one is the fact that Malawi's involvement in tobacco growing has been high. I think the country is also glued to the tobacco industry because it's really huge. And the tobacco industry has got influence. And one would not expect that an industry which benefits from tobacco would find it profitable to promote. So it could interfere in the process. So such interference also has been described as one of the things that could limit this particular support that the farmers are getting. And I think the third one, I think I already alluded to when I was discussing about government's dependence on the crop and the farmers. It's actually the lack of a well-structured market for the alternatives. The alternatives are not as structured as the tobacco industry.
What else then in terms of alternatives? What are some of the crops do you think they should be able to transition to with the right support?
There is a lot of potential for legumes. So you have soybeans, sunflower. But you also have some of the farmers, they do grow on a very small scale, some fruits and some tubers, but mainly the legumes. So when we were doing our research, farmers could actually show us there is potential if given adequate support.
A few years ago, Mr. Nyirenda, there were proposals, I think, from the Malawian government that said that some of the tobacco farmers could transition into growing cannabis for medicinal purposes. What happened to that project?
There was a legalization for production of cannabis for industrial use. Right now, it's actually being championed, not at that scale, but what transpired, I think, especially looking at from the smallholder farmer, is that there was a complaint that the license, I think it's very expensive for even for a smallholder farmer. So right now, I don't think there are any smallholder farmers really are doing that at a small scale. This could be more profitable for commercial and the business-oriented type of farmers, the large-scale ones.
But did the farmers think it would work for them before they found out it would be very expensive to actually be able to get a license to do the same?
Yeah, actually, there was a lot of excitement. Everybody was talking about it as if it was going to be very easy and it was going to benefit the farmers on the ground. At the moment, not much has been done that could suffice really to substitute tobacco or to help the farmers to move away from tobacco, yeah.
What next then for the farmers that are growing tobacco in Malawi? What happens to them?
They're actually in a state of confusion. When you ask them, what do you think then? Because they're saying, look, we want to move away from tobacco, but we are not getting enough support to move to other crops. We have even tried to grow them, but we don't find markets, we don't find that support. So government needs to come to rescue to these farmers. Then other stakeholders like non-government organizations and others who are there just to support for no profit at all, that could be the way to move forward. So government should champion this. There should be agricultural extension services provided by government, not provided necessarily by the industry, but provided by the government itself.
Thank you to Maynard Nyirenda. We've also received a written testimony from a farmer in Malawi, which we have voiced up. Let's listen.
My name is Sonia Ellison. Since 2003, I have dedicated myself to tobacco farming. However, the global decline in tobacco demand has severely impacted my livelihood, making it increasingly difficult to meet basic needs such as food, adequate shelter, and education for my children. Despite assurances from tobacco companies to encourage crop diversification, the accompanying support for market access and resources is either inadequate or entirely absent. The support in place predominantly favors tobacco over alternative crops, such as legumes, limiting our opportunities for diversification. Consequently, we remain trapped in a cycle of dependency on tobacco. The path forward appears bleak. Without concrete guidance and viable alternatives from governments and other stakeholders, our reliance on tobacco as a primary income source persists. We are often encouraged to diversify, yet this advice comes with no clear direction or market to sell the crops we grow. The loans associated with this diversification program further burdens us as we struggle to repay debts without a reliable income. If meaningful support for alternative crops with established markets were made available by the government, our situation could improve significantly. Until then, we continue to grapple with the challenges posed by an industry that has become increasingly unsustainable for people like myself.
Thank you to Nsonia. We will be speaking to Malawi's agricultural minister in another episode of Focus on Africa to find out what's going on. Focus on Africa was put together by Yvette Twagira Maria and Bella Hassan in London. Connie Sharp was a senior journalist in charge. Philip Bull was a technical producer. And our editors are Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi. I'm Charles Kitonga. Thanks for listening.